As you know, I did want to talk to you last year when the Hardbound came out. I know that your wife is very ill, and you
yes.
were up to talking about it then, and I appreciated that. But I saved the book.
I'm glad you did.
Because I figured that one of these days I'd be talking to you again, and I'm delighted that the book came out in paperback. Incidentally, we used to bump into each other on the subway going down Central Park West on one or two occasions.
Very probably we did.
You live up in the upper, low 90s, I think.
96th Street, yeah.
And although I've left that subway, I've abandoned that subway for the Broadway line, which is now air-conditioned.
Yes, it's a fine subway to abandon, the 8th Avenue. It's a terrible line.
Yeah, when it runs.
When it runs. If it runs, it's terrible.
It's more convenient because I live in Park
West. Where do you live? You live in Park West Village, so we're right to your neighbors.
Yeah, and of course, the subway comes right up into Park
sure.
West Village, and it's more convenient for me. And the 96th Street subway station at Broadway is a pit.
Yes.
But the trains are nice, and they run.
Yes.
And even at night, if I work late at night and don't want to spring for a taxi, I can go over to the subway station at 50th Street in Broadway, and within a minute or 2 minutes, there is an air-conditioned, clean train.
Yeah.
Often with a cop on it.
Yeah. I don't know why it's so bad on 8th Avenue, but it really has been always, always the worst of the lines.
Well, I've noticed that, well, some of the trains are cleaner. I was on the line a week or two ago, and I was on a very bad train until it got down to 59th Street, and a wonderful train came in. It was air conditioned and no graffiti.
Oh, nice.
So maybe it's gradually
maybe.
Going to change.
Maybe. We can hope.
Where is your editor-in-chief of Dutton?
I'm the president and publisher of Dutton.
President.
President and publisher, yeah, finally made that.
You've been knocking around and publishing for many years. How did you get into it?
I got into publishing by wanting to be a writer and finding that I wasn't good enough to do that, certainly not to support a wife and two children. So I got into magazine work, actually, as a book reviewer.
Wait a minute. Let's go back a little bit. How would you conclude that you're not good enough?
Well, nobody was buying the material that I was writing. I mean, it's a clear sign that if you want to support your family, not the way to do it is. I wrote plays and a couple of very early high school and college novels. I always wanted to be a writer, but the serious writing. I mean, I went many years without writing, and decided that at least there was some proximity to the authors, and that's the theme of the book: the person who is not first rate, who nevertheless has longings to be first rate. And I've made this longing into an agent, not an editor, but they're very analogous.
Well, wait, let's talk in kind of a chronological way and move up to Works of Genius.
Sure.
And go back. Where did you go to? Where was your higher education?
My higher education was a degree in English literature from bachelor's degree in English literature from Haverford College, and then I took a master's at Columbia.
Mm-hmm. Well, are you a New Yorker?
I'm a New Yorker.
Born in New York?
Born, raised, here. Always been here.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
I grew up in a household, much more a musical household than a literary one. My father was an executive, in my teens anyway, he was an executive at RCA. And the house was filled with great musicians, Toscanini and Horowitz and Rubinstein, and the great performers, really, of their age. And my father's passion was music, but another passion was literature. He was a friend of Thomas Mann's, for instance, translated a story of Mann's. And I grew up in that kind of environment. So always, literature was part of me always.
In Manhattan?
In Manhattan.
And, of course, growing up a kid in Manhattan, you have such proximity to the great cultural attributes.
Sure.
I mean, it's not like Toledo.
No, you have the theater here, which is wonderful. And I was a passionate theater goer as a child, still am. I go much less often because I don't think it's as good, or maybe I've just gotten cynical or older or poorer. I don't know. But I used to go all the time.
So you got out of Columbia with your master's degree, and you wanted to make it as a writer, but
yeah.
It wasn't paying off at that time.
Right. So I went, I went into the Army, came out of the Army, and then got a job at McCall's Magazine working on a column called Sight and Sound. It was my column. And it was book reviews, record reviews, movie reviews, and interviews. I hated it after a while, but for...
You could do anything you wanted. You hated it.
I couldn't do anything I wanted. It was really very... I remember writing a review of a movie called The Island, I think, Antonioni movie. His first, L'Avventura it was called. Then an old Antonioni movie, and I thought it was a masterpiece. I just loved it. And I wrote this wonderful review of it, and it was cut. Probably rightly by the editor who said, I mean, there's not a single reader of McCall's who's going to even get a chance to see this movie, let alone want to see it. And that's probably true. So I found myself doing a lot of Doris Day, Rock Hudson stuff, and that Paul's after a while. It was fun for a while.
Well, parenthetically, this is not going to be part of the interview, of course. It will be excised, but I bumped into the vice president, general manager of this station in the hall this morning, and he said, did you do the Dukes of Flatbush? I said, what? Duke Snider, books of Flatbush,
right.
The Dukes of Flatbush. He said, you know who Duke Snider is? And I said, oh, yeah, of course, I know who Duke Snider is. I said, no, I didn't do that one. He said, but last week you had some woman on the air named Penelope Lively.
Right.
You know, so, you know, they're giving me signs that maybe I should start doing people like Duke Snider, which I just can't.
Yeah.
What would I talk to him about?
Baseball. Otherwise, you're in trouble.
I was telling the GM that ever since Mazeroski hit that home run in 1960 mm-hmm. to have the Pirates win the pennant, the series over the Yankees, I haven't followed the game.
Oh, well, then you're in trouble. Duke Snider. Very bad trouble with Duke Snider.
So, McCall's, you were unhappy with what they were putting you through, or popularizing your column.
Well, I knew what my audience was, and I kind of enjoyed the column. I got sick of interviewing movie stars who were very cranky for the most part and didn't really want to be interviewed. And I began to hate also going to the movies early in the morning. There were screenings. The screenings were 3 months, as you know, 3 months before the magazine went to press because we needed that kind of lead time. Unlike a Daily Reviewer, these were held often before the movie had been finally cut. And they were often shown early in the morning. It's like drinking before breakfast. I mean, you just can't do it. To emerge from a movie house at 12:30 in the afternoon makes no sense to me. I mean, I found it pretty awful. And the movies were, if you see 5-6 movies a week, it gets deadening.
Of course, I prefer to go in the morning before they start smoking joints.
Well, fair enough. They weren't joints. Well, this was a long time ago. I didn't know what a joint was in 1956.
I thought it was a place where you had
exactly. Right. Grass was something you walked on. You know.
So, what happened with your job at McCall?
Well, I felt very much that I wanted to go into book publishing, that magazines were not for me. And I had read a book, a wonderful book, called The Blood of the Lamb by Peter DeVries, who, this was, I think, the only book that he wrote, which is a tragic book. It's about the death of his child by leukemia. And we had had a child, my wife and I, who also had died very recently. And I had read the book and was deeply moved by it and was crying in my office one day. And Herb Mays, who was the editor of McCall's at the time, came by me and said, what's the matter? And I said, oh, this is a wonderful book here. And he said, oh, for Christ's sake, pull yourself together. And I was furious at him. And I called Little Brown, which is the publisher of the DeVries book, and I said, I have to talk to somebody about this book. Who's the editor? And the head of Little Brown said, there's a man named Alan Williams. He's in New York. Why don't you call him there? And I called Alan, and I told him this story. Alan told me that he had burst into tears on a commuter train going to Bucks County in Pennsylvania, and people had just moved away from him in the train, coming to the same portion, which had moved me so. And Alan invited me to lunch. And we had lunch together, and he said, are you happy at McCall's? And I said, no, get me a job if you can in publishing. And he did the requisite thing, which was to write to all his friends. And I went on a round of interviews. Finally, 7 months later, got a job at Macmillan.
As
an editor, as a junior editor, mm-hmm. In charge of refurbishing the backlist, those books which stay in print for a while and needed updating. I did that and learned a lot about publishing doing that.
That sounds like a rather mechanical
job. It was a fairly mechanical job. There was a lot of simply putting new jackets on or getting new introductions written and so on. And I wouldn't have, if that had been all, I would have been very unhappy. But also part of it was the acquiring of new books. Mm. And it started me going.
Mm. What were some of the books, early books that you acquired?
The first book I acquired, I remember it vividly, was a biography of Aaron Burr by two high school teachers. Herb Parmet was one of them, and forgot the name of the woman. Isn't that terrible? I'll think of it in a minute. They wrote Marie Hecht was her name, and they wrote a wonderful biography of Burr, which I did indeed publish, and to great success, even though they had no real academic credentials. They were just high school teachers.
How long did you stay at Macmillan?
5 years.
And then what happened?
And then I went on to World. I had...
World? That's in Cleveland.
The main offices were in Cleveland. That was the dictionary and reference books were in Cleveland. But the trade division was in New York, mm-hmm. on 59th Street.
That's long gone now.
Long gone. It was a terrible place. But...
They had a lot of reprints, didn't they? They
didn't do so many reprints. It was the hardcover arm, really, as Dutton is now of the American
Library.
But they
had hardcover reprints,
didn't they? They did some, but not a lot. It was mostly new publishing, mm-hmm. and it was not a well run company. We didn't like the president, and he was very tough to work with and for. And it went downhill very quickly. I didn't like it there. I was there for a couple of years, a little more than 2.5 years.
It was on
the skids at that time. And the author I published there was a fellow named Robert Ludlum, however, a major author.
Ah, really?
With whom I had been working at Macmillan, and Macmillan gave him up very quickly, and I just took him with me to World, where he became quite a success.
Too bad he couldn't have stayed with you.
Well, he stayed with me for 9 books, so it's...
that's not bad.
That's a long run. Yeah. I'm not with him now, but 9 books worth was fine. And on the basis, I think, of the success of the... Well, the first book had been turned down by a woman named Helen Meyer, who ran Dell Paperback Publishing Company, which was also the owned a small press called the Dial Press, wonderful press, wonderful publisher. And Helen called me one day and said, would you like to come over? And I said, yes, and she hired me. At Dial. To be the editor-in-chief of Dial. The reason was not to get me, but to get Ludlum, because she had turned the book down originally and then wound up buying it for paperback after it had been revised for a good deal of money. I think it was $150,000, something like that. A lot of money in those days for a first novel.
It's not bad today, either.
Not bad today, either, no. Certainly not. But in those days, really astonishing for a first book. And, of course, it paid back many, many times over. So I published a lot of Bob's work and went from publishing house to publishing house, really, with him.
I believe you were at Dial when I first met you. When
probably.
I did the Schlossberg book.
The Schlossberg book was at Dial. That's right.
And, of course, you had gone to Putnam. Because I think you'd gone to Putnam.
Yeah, Putnam was after Dial.
The reason it is coming back now. The reason is I did go to Dial to interview Yuri Yuryevich.
That's right.
Who had picked up the book.
Right. That's right. It was just during the publication of that book that I left.
And Yuri, I understand, has his own little house down in the village.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything that he's done yet. I don't know if he's done anything.
I haven't either. No.
So you went to Putnam for a while. That was really a growing outfit.
Putnam was growing very rapidly. I went to Putnam and was hired there because, I'm sure, of Ludlum, who by that time was a star. There were an awful lot of copies sold of the hardcovers of Ludlum's books by then. We were in the many hundreds of thousands. And he left me after the 9th book. To go off on his own. He said he didn't want so close a relationship between editor and author, and I can understand that. I mean, I think there's valid psychological reason for it. And so he went off to Random House, and I stayed just a few more months at Putnam when I was fired, and simply then went on to St. Martin's, where again I had my own imprint, and where I was very happy.
And you left St. Martin's to go to
Dutton? Dutton, where, because I guess everybody in my lifetime wanted to be the president. I mean, wanted to put all my theories about publishing, which were patently more brilliant than anybody else's, and of course are the same as anybody else's, into practice.
But
and now I can do that.
About publishing, you have been to so many places, and even doing this Mike Schlossberg book many years ago, I found that there was such a tremendous turnover in publishing. What? Why? My father, for example, is still alive. But he worked for the same company his entire life, one company. And I've been at CBS for 21 years, which is very unusual for broadcasting.
Yeah.
But in publishing, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, zappo, they're gone.
One of the reasons is that it's very hard to get raises in publishing by staying at the same house. Most houses have a probably reasonable policy of giving 5% raises, 10% raises, whatever it is, fairly much across the board. And to make a big jump you must almost invariably go to another house. Also, maybe even more significant, it certainly was more significant in my case, you get to know how people think in a publishing house. And there are many ideas in publishing, all of them valid and invalid at the same time. Some of them work and some of them don't. You really don't have much of an idea what is going to work and what isn't. And if you play off different people, then ideas spark, it seems to me. And publishing is so much, particularly the marketing of books, is so much a matter of sparking that it's nice to have different ideas.
So what you're saying is you have to move around in order to keep that spark going.
Sure, sure.
Is publishing a lucrative industry?
Yes, it is. I think that certainly parts of publishing are extremely lucrative. Not regular trade publishing, which is books for bookstores. Textbook publishing is enormously lucrative. Wisely run trade publishing houses, houses that print novels and biographies and nonfiction of all kinds, make a fairly good profit. Each individual book is not necessarily profitable, however.
Well,
everybody has talked about the fact that publishing isn't, that the margins in publishing are very small, and in fact return on investment is probably less in publishing than it is in most other industries. Nevertheless, you can get pretty rich being a publisher. A lot of people have.
A publisher?
Yes.
Like
Simon
like
Schuster.
Like yourself?
Well, I'm
a
salaried employee. I'm talking about somebody who actually owns the company.
Well, I see these, like Mary Higgins Clark's five-year or five-book or three-book, whatever
right.
it is, contract for $10 million.
Something like that. Yeah.
And yet I look at the want ads in Publishers Weekly, and all these jobs there seem to start at 18,000.
18 is high. a starting editorial assistant at most publishing houses will make somewhere around $14,000 or $15,000.
How do you get people attracted to publishing?
Because the job is so wonderful. The profession is so wonderful that people want to.
But how do they live while they're enjoying publishing?
They live by living, I suspect, with many roommates in unpleasant surroundings. And I think that's part of that's part of the price. I mean, I know that. I mean, I've been to parties at these houses. And say, well, listen, I started at $12,000.
But that was in...
That was in 50... Well, really in 59. 61 in publishing at $12,000. But I had a wife and two kids. And I took another job. I mean, I had a daytime job, which was my publishing job, and a nighttime job, which was a writing job. I edited a small magazine for the Hammond Organ Company. Wrote and edited it.
Well, so, you've spent all of these years as an editor and publisher, and of course you started out many years ago thinking that, gosh, I'd like to be a writer.
Yes.
And yet it worked out. Somehow you came full circle, and you did become a writer with your novel Works of Genius. So I guess this creative impulse never went away in all these years.
It lay dormant for a long time. That is, I didn't really have the drive to write a novel. I woke up one morning with this novel. I was in Jerusalem at the book fair, and very jet-lagged, and so woke up at around 4 o'clock in the morning, feeling terrible, but with an absolutely clear vision in my head of a particular scene. And I knew it was a scene from a book. I had no idea which book, obviously. There was a woman. There was a woman lying naked under a tree with her eyes open. And I didn't know whether her eyes were open in satisfaction or stupefaction. And I wondered how she got there and who she was. And that was really the germ of this book. In the book, there were three people under a tree, but it started with a woman alone. And I thought of writing for the first time in many years, certainly 20 years or something like that, to see what the process was like from the other side. I had written in college, but I hadn't, and I'd written short stories, which had been published, again, when I was very young. I just wanted to see what it was like from the other side of the desk.
Well, I hope it made you, as an editor and publisher, more sympathetic for the poor writing slob
out there. Far more sympathetic. The guilt I have now of not this book, my book was turned down by 8 publishers, and in a process that took almost a year of rejections before it was accepted.
You who has rejected so many,
I
had 8 rejections?
I had 8 rejections, indeed. Some of them nice and some of them nasty.
They're getting back at you, Richard.
Well, they didn't know it was me. I submitted the book under a pseudonym, so because I didn't want to influence anything one way or another. I mean, I didn't want my friends to buy out of sympathy, and I didn't want my enemies to say no out of animosity. So I submitted it under a pseudonym. But and indeed have waited 6 to 8 to 9 weeks without ever getting an answer in agony. I do try now to answer faster. The books that come to me. No question. That's the worst part of it. It's simply not hearing is terrible.
Well, now, tell me about the characters in Works of Genius. We have not a publisher or an editor, but an agent who deals with a writer who is certainly a genius, but who has a tremendous ego and who, in his way, destroys the lives of the people around him. First of all, tell me about the agent.
Well, the agent is in some respects, anyway, myself. That is, as an editor, and as what I thought of myself as being, which was not a first-rate writer, still interested in first-rate writing, I became enamored of writers themselves. And I wanted, it was as close as I could get to really good writing. I was an editor of James Baldwin's editor, for instance, for many, many years. And the simple proximity of somebody who is that good was a great pleasure to me. A vicarious pleasure, but nevertheless a great pleasure. And an agent, it seemed to me, was an easy way of stepping away from being an editor, which didn't seem to me to be so interesting. An agent knows something about business as well and has a different kind of connection with writers. But I did want very much to have somebody one step away from being a great writer himself, but still very much in search of it, wanting to be with it. And the extent that he would go to, the amount of horror that he would put up with, in order to have greatness around him. It's a theme that has interested me.
Of course, when he deals with the writer in the book, I think at one point, it's been a year since I've read Works of Genius,
yeah,
but I think at one point when he loses the writer, his name is Meredith, right?
Eric Meredith.
That was his writer. He was living on that one writer. Is that typical? Do agents live on a single writer?
No, in fact, he has other writers as well, but a writer, I mean, like book publishers, if you have one superstar, I was Ludlum's publisher, the loss of Ludlum was, to my little own imprint, devastating. There was a difference of millions, literally millions of dollars, in the income that the imprint had. A bigger house, such as Simon Schuster or Dutton or something like that, can of course afford to lose a big writer much more easily. There's still a great deal of pain involved. And a literary agent just starting out, as Tony is in this book, really became an important agent through one writer. He had many others. People were attracted by the fact that he had another, that he had a big star. But he moves in the book from working out of his house to working out of very opulent offices on Madison Avenue. And the loss of a writer of Eric's stature would represent a calamity.
It was also a calamity for the editor in the publishing house that was publishing.
Also
when he pulled out, what happened to the editor?
The editor gets fired.
Is this normal?
Well, it happened to me. I don't know if it's normal, but it's not a surprise.
But would this happen at Dutton? If an editor had a big property and he lost it through no fault of his own?
No, it would not happen at Dutton.
As long as you're there.
As long as I'm there.
Yeah. It's just not right. It's not fair.
No.
It reminds me of the time I was offered a job. I was offered the chance to leave CBS to become a partner in a public relations firm. in which I would invest. And the reason I've been offered that job was that I would bring in money because they were having a cash flow problem.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't want me just because they figure I might be a good writer and knew something about communications and could do the things that a public relations person could do.
Yeah.
I mean, there were ulterior motives. So I have a feeling that in some instances where you have an editor who brings in a great property and he loses it, he's no longer a value to the publishing house, even though he still may be a good editor.
That's quite so. I felt that very strongly when I was fired from Putnam, that I had no value to the publishing house anymore.
And yet, you might have been able to turn a new author in the following week.
I might have been able to. They were not interested in that.
Let's go on to Meredith now. Here is a practically a maniacal person, obviously a genius. Are writers really like that?
No. No.
Some writers are, though.
Well, Eric is an exaggeration. I'm interested in figures, well, like Wagner is the easiest example, and really he was in the back of my mind when I created Eric, who are true monsters, but in their works exhibit a humanity, well, they exhibit a humanity in their works which they do not exhibit in their daily personal lives. That's an interesting character to me. Eric is based on three or four different people I've known. Almost all the cruelty in him is magnified. I mean, I wanted to make him a melodramatic figure. I wanted him to be larger than indeed life. But there are some pretty terrible stories of author behavior in publishing, few of which have happened to me, but they are fairly well known. And I began to see in Eric some traits that I had seen in other writers. I just made them bigger. I mean, it's very rare that a writer would drive his wife to suicide.
These traits, however, probably are not noticeable at the beginning, are they?
No, the traits are not, indeed. And in Eric, they're not either. I think that fame, certainly the kind of fame that Eric attains very rapidly, does something bad to the brain or the psyche. I'm not sure that this sudden world fame and incredible riches is so good for anybody.
But there is something about having a published book behind you that does please one, please the writer, and it does show that there is a whether the book is as good as it might be is one thing, but it does show a sense of accomplishment.
Oh, absolutely.
I was talking to a young woman who had written the first novel, and it was not a bad novel, not a great novel, but recently. And she was sitting here where you are, and she says, "Well, I hope this novel is not going to change my life." I liked her. She mm-hmm. was really nice. But I had to say, in all honesty, it probably won't change your life. She's planning parties and everything. And it had a couple of modest reviews. Probably will never go into a second printing. Might sell a couple of thousand copies.
Sure. And the fate of most first novels.
Yeah. And indeed, that is what happened. It's been several months since the book was out.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't cause any great stir. But it was not a bad book.
Yeah.
And it was a nice first novel, and it shows that she could do it, and she could go on to other things. But I think that some writers may have an exaggerated idea about their importance and their ability.
Sure, I try to, when I deal with first novels and when the people who work with and for me deal with first novelists, they are instructed to give a speech to those novelists as to tamp down the fan. I mean, after all, when you're writing a novel by yourself, when you're alone, two things are going through your head simultaneously. One of them is, get out of the way, Tolstoy, here I come. Right? God's gift to literature is on his way. And the other is, every word on this page is junk. I mean, those two things go through your, I mean, you've written books yourself, so you know that that's true. And I think it's true of even the very best writers. I know first-rate writers who have written wonderful things who have called me and said, this is just terrible. Just, I can't stand it, it's so bad. People who have burnt books because they don't like the start of it. I've known such people. So those twin things are going through your head. When the book is bought, particularly the first book is bought by a publishing house, the Tolstoy side wins. I mean, some objective voice has said to the writer, you're good, you're good enough to be published. And that does, then the fantasies start to build. So it's good to slow them down a little bit.
In my case, my book has a publishing history. I just gave it to Joan and she bought it.
Right. Well, that's
and when
how
she,
nice.
And when she called me and said, I'm taking it. Mm-hmm. And I said, you got to be kidding. And so immediately I sat down and rewrote it.
Yeah.
Because I didn't like the draft I sent her. And then I rewrote it a second time. So I don't know. I shouldn't have intruded with that that episode. But the feeling that it wasn't good does prevail. And I don't think that I ever felt that the book was good, and I don't feel that it is to this day. But I was talking to a great West Coast writer, lives out of Seattle. Ivan, I can't think of his last name. And I was saying the same thing to him. I'll think of his name after a bit. Saying the same thing to him. He said, why are you complaining? They're publishing it. But I think it's more than that.
Oh, sure.
I mean, you want a book that's not going to embarrass you.
Well, there are two things. One is that the book is in the Library of Congress, and so it will never die. And the second thing is that it does indeed have a publisher's name on it, but your name is larger. And it is a public act, which is very scary. It is my firm belief that every single book, and surely every work of fiction, is in some way autobiographical. And, I mean, even if it only represents the fantasy that's going on in the head of the writer, it's his fantasy.
Yeah.
Most books are more directly autobiographical than that. And, therefore, you are taking a terrific risk. You are putting yourself out, granted, in disguise, but it is yourself who is being offered to an uncaring public.
And you don't want to be in a position that Gordon Lish was in recently.
Certainly done.
Lambasted. I was amazed the Publishers Weekly did that to him, and it made page six of the Post and all of that.
Sure.
That's very embarrassing.
Very
embarrassing. I have always admired him, or at least his courage in doing what he's done, if not always the things he's done.
Yeah.
Well, how did you, as a longtime editor, find the time to sit down and write a book?
I got up an hour earlier every single morning and wrote a page. Even if it was, if a book was, if the last word on the page was hyphenated and would be continued on the next page, I stopped at the end of the page. And I did it every single day, including Christmas, for however many days, 400 some odd days.
But how did you know where you were? It seems to me you have to read, you have to read 30 or 40 pages just to get back into the pace.
I did two things. I wrote an extremely careful outline, something I would recommend to any writer, and certainly any first writer. And secondly, I made all sorts of ridiculous mistakes in that first draft. I would read the page that I had finished the day before, which kept me going. And also, these books stay in your head. They really do. I mean, those characters were with me all day long. And I woke up thinking about them, and with great pleasure, going to the typewriter and banging out another page in the adventures of Tony and Eric. But they, when the book was finished, it was a horrible mess. The hero's wife was pregnant three different times for dramatic purposes, a physical impossibility. And two of those were cut in the revision. The revision, it took me some 400 days or so to finish a draft, and what I had was 400 pages and a very, very messy group they were.
Did you depend on an editor to help you?
No, I went back and worked very carefully revising, and those were in long stretches. I mean, I would take weekends off for 1 year, my entire vacation, I just simply took the 3 weeks and worked nonstop early in the morning to late at night and on the book, revising it and putting it into shape. And then it was submitted to a number of houses, as I say, 8 rejections, until it was bought by Athenaeum. And then I got an editorial letter, the kind of editorial letter that I would write to an author in my editing guise. 7 single-spaced pages of criticism and wishes for changes. Some of them so humiliating, that it's hard to believe. I mean, things that I would have caught in anybody else's book, I missed in my own completely. And this after innumerable readings. And indeed help from a writer friend who had edited it and also caught things that were humiliating. But your objectivity goes as a writer. The characters are in your head. They are, you know what the inflection of their voice is. You know what they're going to say. And therefore, when it appears on the page, it seems to you that that is actually what they're saying, when in fact you may have missed it completely.
It's a wonderful thing to pick up a book and read a story with such grace, as though it had always been there. No human being really turned this out. It's too perfect.
Yeah.
But to sit there and work and sweat and have such self-doubts about it. So, but you as an editor and a writer still needed an editor.
Oh, badly. Very badly. Her name is Susan Ginsberg. I'm very grateful to her.
Well, meaning the writer and the editor, produced a wonderful book and works of genius, and it says a lot about the publishing industry, of which I have been an observer for many years. So I was having these literary aspirations of my own and not having the time to do it as yourself until more recently, when I'm, like you, plowing ahead or trying to now. So this was comforting to read it and to understand how things work. Because it's still, writing still and editing is still a lot of guesswork, isn't it?
Total guesswork. My guess is likely to be better than yours, but it's still a guess. It's only likely to be better because I've had more experience and I know pretty much what will sell and what won't. If I truly knew what would sell or what wouldn't, I would be a very wealthy person. But I don't, and I've made lots of mistakes both ways.
You're doing okay. Richard Merrick, thank you very much.
Sure, a lot of fun.